I'm Claire Daly and you're listening to the Bloomsbury Institute podcast, recorded live at Bloomsbury Publishing in Bedford Square, London. For details of our future events and to listen to all of our other podcasts, go to www.bloomsburyinstitute.com.
Patrick. I'm just going to talk about Patrick for a little while. Patrick was born in London and he was brought up not in Broadmoor, but very close to Broadmoor. For the reason that I think most people know, that his father was medical superintendent in that establishment, and that has had a very profound effect on his work. I don't know about his life, but definitely his work. And he was educated, I saw this today when I was looking up on Wikipedia, I didn't know before, at Stonyhurst, which is also, I think, quite interesting.
Stonyhurst is a story.
Okay, I think we might go back to that.
Bad story.
So Patrick grew up in the shadow of Broadmoor Hospital, and he grew to be a man, and he published his first book, Blood and Water and Other Tales, in 1988, I think it was, 88, which was a short story collection. And was that the one that Penguin published in that strange configuration, or was that a later one?
Where your name was on
yes.
the back.
Yes, there was a very sort of special moment in Penguin's history, and I vividly remember, as a young publisher, I was working at Virago at the time, going to the party in a nightclub in Covent Garden,
a very dark establishment.
There's somebody here who will remember it vividly, because she was Patrick's editor, Geraldine. And there were these actually not dissimilar shaped books to this one today. They were rather square, but Penguin thought it was very chic to not put the author or the title, or at least certainly not the author on the book. So it was avant-garde publishing. And that in some way also had something to do with, I think, what happened to Patrick out there in the world. And the word Gothic, of course, is the word that is most closely associated. And that's something I'd like to go back to and talk about later. And then there was the first novel with the title The Grotesque, which of course also makes you think of the Gothic. And then we went into Spider, which was made into that film by David Cronenberg, Dr. Haggard's Disease, Asylum, Martha Peake, and then to our great joy at Bloomsbury, he joined us with Portmongo in 2004, which was followed by Trauma and Constance, which we're publishing today. He also, in 2005, published with Bloomsbury a collection of tales that were all to do with Manhattan that was supposed to be, and indeed was, in our Writers in the City series, but Patrick would not be confined by what was supposed to be a non-fiction account of a writer's city. But no, he went straight into fiction. And
well, I didn't go straight in. I tried to figure out a way to write about New York in a non-fictional way, but came up blanks, and I thought, write stories about New York. Will that do? I said to Liz Corbett, and she said, yes, that will do.
And it did. Before Patrick starts to talk about his book and to read from it, I would like to read to you two things that have been written so far about this book, which I particularly love and think really say important things about the book. And one came from John Banville. And he says, Patrick McGrath is one of the age's most elegantly accomplished divers into the human psyche. And in his new novel, he brings us another resident sounding from that deep well. Constance is an intricate, multi-layered, and in the end, surprisingly tender work from a master writer. And then, to our great joy in the New York Times, and it was a particular joy because Patrick has, with this book, been published by Bloomsbury in America for the first time. Julie Myerson wrote a review which is simply fantastic, and you should all look it up if you haven't seen it. And I'm just going to read a bit of it. Trance-like, the novel's effects are oddly, cumulatively hypnotic. As a piece of monomaniacal writing, McGrath's strange narrative never fails to grip and startle. But as a study of emotional and sexual anesthesia, of marital numbness, of the way of force, loss, trauma, and a drastic, fatal desire for control, are what this novel is really about, and as a whole performance slowly won me over, many of McGrath's glorious phrases made me catch my breath. One of these, a sort of muted sexual uproar, was one of them. I can't put it in context without spoiling things for the reader, but I can't resist quoting it either, because it perfectly sums up the dark, ecstatic flavour of this unforgettable book. So welcome, Patrick, and to unforgettable book.
Thank you very much for being here. Thank you, Hatchards. Thank you very much, Alexandra, and Bloomsbury. And I have to say, this was a difficult book to write. I'll explain a little why in a moment. But in the writing of it, I needed the help and the engagement of several colleagues who were very important to me. One was Alexandra, and one who I'd like to publicly acknowledge tonight here is Deborah Rogers, who was present here, who was just wonderfully involved with the writing of this book and read, I don't know how many drafts. They came in just a steady onslaught of drafts. And every single one of them got read. I remember at one point the phone rang in New York early in the morning. It was Deborah's voice. And without any prelude, the words came, do you mean that Mildred has been sleeping with Daddy? And anyway, so it was a difficult book because Constance was a very difficult woman to understand. She held some allure to me when I first began to flesh her or bring her to life in my imagination. But there was a certain aloofness about her, a certain distance, a certain inaccessibility that I couldn't get at, that I was eager to define in some way. And I remember that I devised for myself an acronym to help me in focus on what it was I was trying to get at. And the acronym was RAOUL, which stood for the Romantic Appeal of Unreliable Lovers. And in my attempt to get at her, I wrote her story in first person, a complete draft, which I then wasn't satisfied with because it only gave the subjective Constance. I realised I needed to show her as others saw her. I needed to give the impression that she made upon the world. And she had a husband. In fact, the book was very much about a marriage. And the husband was called Sidney. But he was very much in the background when Constance told her own story, which tells you something about Constance. So I thought, I'll give the story to Sidney, and he can tell Constance's story. So I wrote the novel all over again from Sidney's point of view, which was quite time-consuming and quite tricky, because there's... when you give a story to a new narrator, you put them into situations, or rather, they need to describe situations that they may not even have been present at. So you have to find some way to allow them to tell you what happened on a given occasion. So then I had it from Sidney's point of view, at which point I think I sent it to you, Alexandra, and you said, but I miss Constance. So that wasn't going to work either. So I then thought, I know what, I have to graft Sidney's account and Constance's account and make it truly the portrait of a marriage. And that part was actually quite a lot of fun because I discovered that, curiously enough, when a husband and wife are both present, both participate in an event, whether it's a social event or even just a conversation between the two of them, if you then look at each of their accounts of that event, there is some difference, often a quite a wide difference between the account that the wife gives and the husband gives. So this allowed me to work in that territory and also to restructure it in such a way that I got the most out of Constance's story. So having said all of that, let me read some pages, and this would be from one of Sidney's sections of the book. In fact, it begins at the point when Sidney is at a literary party in Manhattan. The year is about 1963, which I think of as the sort of the last days of the patriarchal husband. Everything is about to go south for the patriarchal husband. Feminism is imminent. And that's the moment we're at in the book. So here is Sidney at his party in Manhattan, and he says, "A few mornings later, an invitation came in the mail. It was to a book party in a townhouse on Sutton Place. I forget whose townhouse, and I forget whose book. I even forget why I went, unless I sensed it was destiny calling. It doesn't matter now. But what I don't forget is the first glimpse I had of a tall, blonde girl in a narrow black skirt, thin as a pencil, no makeup, with long legs and a pursed, tight little mouth. She was standing by an open window with a martini in her hand, silent and aloof amid the shrieking hubbub of civilized conversation all around her. Her lips were moving slightly. She's often told me that when she saw me pushing through the crowd in her direction, she looked for the means of escape, but there was none. What she remembered most clearly, she said, was my damp mouth and my pink bow tie. I was apparently nodding my head at her as I eased through the throng, as though to say, you, yes, you, it's you I want. Sidney Klein, I said, when at last I stood before her. You're English? I'm afraid so. So it started. We shook hands. I still can't explain why I felt such an immediate attraction to this young woman, unless it was carnal. But there was an air of angry untouchability about her that interested me considerably, which I assumed concealed fearful bewilderment and naivete. It's often the mask assumed by girls new to the city. And there was something else too, a kind of fineness, not at once obvious. And although to the casual glance she might appear to be a plain girl, that fineness was a powerful attractor, and I just wanted to get physically close to her. I never lost the feeling. What she saw in me was less flattering. I'm a tall man, perhaps a little on the heavy side, but I dress well. I always have. I feel too much. It is no accident that I am an authority on romantic poetry. It was a warm evening. I was in my light seersucker, and apparently there were beads of sweat on my forehead. The effect, she said later, was that of an obscure consular official going quietly mad in a far-flung outpost of empire. But there was, too, without question, she said, some force of personality there. She also said, I was panting in the heat like a dog. I suggested we go somewhere quiet where we could talk. She asked me what I wanted to talk about, and I said I wanted to talk about her. Why? Why not? We both knew she was about to leave the party with me. When we were out on the street, I proposed a quiet French restaurant in the village. Then we were back, then we were in the back of a cab and I kissed her and she let me. She wanted me to. She liked me. I was so much older than her, at least 40, she thought. And she felt that with me she'd be safe. I only wish I'd kept her safer. I should have kept her under lock and key. When I kissed her, I held her cheek and chin in my fingers. Her skin was like a child's, and her lips were soft and cool enough, although they wouldn't part for me. I felt her body stiffen in involuntary protest at first, but I paid no attention to that, and after a moment she relaxed and draped a long, thin arm around my neck and briefly kissed me back, but again without involvement of the tongue. For that I'd have to wait. Then she disengaged herself and stared out the window of the cab. At dinner we talked, as I said we would, about her. I figured her to be about 23, but for some reason she sustained the chilly hauteur I'd seen at the party, and I soon began to feel she had no right to it, not having earned it. I persevered, however, still bewitched, or fired up at least, with strong emotions loosely rooted in lust. Then, as we lingered over our coffee and cigarettes, she at last started to open up. I don't know why. Perhaps she took pity on me, or perhaps she thought I was harmless. I'd asked her about her childhood, and she told me she'd grown up with her sister, Iris, in a falling-down house in the Hudson Valley, complete with a framed veranda and a tower. It had been in her family for generations, she said, but when I asked her how many generations, she was vague. Oh, two at least, she said. Daddy grew up there. Stood high on a fissured bluff, and on the south side of the property, a steep wooded slope descended to a wetland meadow where the railroad tracks and the river. This was the view she'd had from her bedroom window, she said. The sweep of the mighty Hudson far below her, with the Catskills in the distance. It was called Ravenswood. It was all too good to be true. The old house with its tower on a bluff above the river, and this beautiful girl, clearly in flight from who knows what horrors she'd suffered there. It was a romantic cliché, the whole thing. But for that, I liked it all the more. In fact, I hadn't spent much time in the Hudson Valley. There was nothing for me up there, apart from a few small liberal arts colleges, none of them of any interest. But this I kept to myself. It hadn't escaped me that this girl got dreamy when she talked about nature. She then produced a photograph and pushed it across the table. It was herself, age 12, sitting with her sister on the porch of that old house, which was, as she described it, and every bit as shabby as I'd imagined. It had a long porch, a tower, several steep gables, and what looked like a screened veranda, a kind of American villa with Gothic additions, and pretty run down. And there she was in the foreground, clutching her school books and frowning at the camera, visibly nervous, her hair pinned up and her slim legs pressed tight together at the knees but splayed at the ankles. She wore white socks and brown sandals with a buckled strap. "What a geek," she said as I studied the photo. I said I was sure she grew out of the awkward stage. All children do. But she said she didn't, not for a long time. Had she yet, I thought. But Iris, the younger sister, she looked like trouble even then. A tooth missing, hair all adrift, scabby knees, a true hoyden in the making. And those eyes, even in that cracked, creased, black and white photo, there was no escaping those big, dark, liquid pools of shining life. Behind the two girls stood an eccentric-looking woman in faded corduroy trousers and a man's shirt and an old straw hat and a trug with a cigarette between her teeth, and I thought at once, English, I know the type. And behind her in the shadow of the doorway, a tall, indistinct figure who reminded me of the pitchfork man in Grant Wood's American Gothic. As I slid the photograph back across the table, she told me, as though in answer to a question I hadn't asked, that she wasn't an extrovert like Iris, but she didn't believe she was frail psychologically. She was a solitary, yes, and Harriet, this was the mother, hadn't tried to make her otherwise. She hadn't tried to make her anything, but she had encouraged her to love her little sister and always look out for her. In this way, she'd helped create a bond between the sisters that was supposed to never come undone. Oh, she'd begun to talk now. The floodgates were opening, and I advanced with care. "Your mother looks like an interesting woman," I said. "Harriet's dead." She lifted her head and stared at me as though to have me look upon her suffering and tremble. Her mother always wanted to be called by her first name, she told me, not Mommy or Mom. "How old were you?" 12. "Iris takes after her. I don't know who I take after. Not Daddy, that's for sure." She said this with a fierce light in her eyes and an angry little laugh. "Not Daddy, that's for sure." "Oh, her. Daddy's a problem." Then she said it was her mother's presence in the house that gave the place a sense of home. "A child takes this for granted," she said, "that the mother's the loving, the living heart of the home. It was all lost when Harriet died." This was said dispassionately, carelessly. But the child's grief was not hard to detect. What happened to this girl, I thought? Why has nobody looked after her? As for the father, Morgan Schuyler, the doctor, she had no difficulty describing him, a terrible, lank, tousled, frowning man in a baggy grey suit with wide suspenders and big dusty brogues on his feet and long, clever fingers stained yellow at the tips by nicotine. She shivered, describing this monster. A house like that, there had to be a wicked father figure. The restaurant was almost empty,
but I wasn't calling for the check just yet. The waiters stood by the end of the counter with long white aprons talking quietly. The bartender was polishing glasses. It was pleasant to be there at that hour. It was all team. I sometimes thought New York did Europe better than Europe did Europe. Go on, I said. In he'd come, she said, her eyes on the table and her voice low and dramatic. And Harriet would at once be on the alert. I wasn't disturbed by it, not at the time. I'd watch him sit down and rub his face. Then he might raise his head and gaze at her with lifted eyebrows, as though to say, tell me something that doesn't involve an ulcer or a tumour or an inflamed bowel. Tell me something about life. Pause here. She was running a fingernail down the seam of the tablecloth, smiling to herself. I think she was amused by the inflamed bowel. Go on, he wanted to be told something about life. Oh, but some days he'd stand at the window and Harriet would catch my eye and put a finger to her lips. And he'd just stare out at the river and his back was all we'd have of him until it debated, I guess. It was tension from some decision he'd made about one of his patients. And he didn't know if he'd done the right thing. I'd heard him talk like that. I heard it through the door of the sitting room or from outside on the veranda when I'd creep under the window so they couldn't see me. Then I'd hear those soft murmuring noises I knew from when I woke up in the night and Harriet came into my bedroom. Another pause. She could be histrionic, this girl. And she was barely conscious of the impression she made. She was engaged exclusively with her own experience. She frowned. So she was trying to undo some sort of tricky mental knot. A lick or two of that fine blonde hair had worked free and she brushed it back impatiently. I offered her a cigarette and she took it. Then she stared straight at me and spoke as though she were delivering a shattering revelation. Or she didn't. There was no knowing. She might ignore me. Sometimes I thought she wasn't my mother at all and I was just some girl Daddy found in a ditch and brought home for his wife to look after. You think that's silly. You think I'm exaggerating. You think I'm a fool. I don't think you're a fool. Quieter now, smoking her cigarette, she turned slightly in her chair to cross her legs and gave me her three-quarter profile. She said she'd often heard voices raised in anger in the sitting room, and then her mother weeping, after which her father stormed out and the door slammed. When that happened, she knew to keep out of her, or out of their way. Where was your sister in all this? She became guarded now. She briefly closed her eyes. Iris is younger than me. She's my kid's sister. She wants to be me. She'd like me to die and get out of her way. She's always been much better with Daddy. She knows how to talk to him about his work. I always thought that was the problem between us. I mean me and Daddy. My indifference to medicine. He's always wanted one of us to be a doctor, and I've made clear it's not going to be me. She glanced at me to see if I was impressed with her independence of spirit. I was more impressed, or astonished rather, by her frank revelation of primal sibling rivalry. She'd like me to die. Then I saw that wild light in her eyes again, and a smile appeared. She leaned forward and whispered, I'd rather walk the streets. Where did that come from? It was exciting. For a second, I glimpsed her standing in a doorway, in an alley, on a wet night. So what happened? She frowned. She was serious again. Oh, but Harriet was very lonely. This was before she got sick. She'd come into my bedroom in tears. She'd tell me Daddy was so mean. Then she'd have me stand behind her at the dressing table and brush her hair. She'd watch me in the mirror. Here she pretended to be her mother and spoke in a languid, sing-song voice. That's lovely, darling. Please don't stop. A little harder. I shouldn't come to you like this. But there's nobody else I can talk to. It's all right. He's tired. He doesn't mean it. Constance looked at me as if to say, you see what he did to her? Outside in the street, some madman was cursing Jesus Christ. She then remarked in an offhand manner that, of course, Harriet was English. So I was right. I understood then that the mother had transmitted something of her Englishness to Constance, and it partly accounted for the attraction she'd aroused in me. Not that I made a fetish of it, being English, I mean, but I did own an English car, a Jaguar. black Mark 8 four-door sedan with straight six engine and twin carburetors. They're quite rare. Barb hated it. She said it was like riding in a hearse. But Harriet would apparently make Constance stand very straight and inspect her. She'd trace the line of her eyebrows with her finger. Sometimes she told her to undress, then examined her as though she were a specimen of some kind. She never told her why. All this I learned that first night in these brief bursts of revelation. Meanwhile, it took some effort on her part to learn anything about me. But when she found out what I did for a living, she was surprised. All the smart women at that party, and you came after me? I lifted my hands, palms outspread. I told her I couldn't figure out what she was. That made her laugh. You and me both, she said.
Okay, I'd like to start by going way back to your childhood.
Oh, dear.
In an interview with you, which I was looking at earlier, there's a quote from you which says, "The criminally insane were very much a feature of my childhood."
That's entirely true. My father was a forensic psychiatrist. He ran Broadmoor for 25 years. And so his patients were what was then called the criminally insane. They were people who had committed usually crimes of great violence while psychotic and were therefore found not guilty by reason of insanity and were sent to Broadmoor, where he and his colleagues treated them.
And how much contact did you have with
him? I had a lot of contact with the patients, not the most disturbed patients, but certainly those who had settled down to the extent that they could leave the hospital proper and work on the gardens of the estate. These I knew well. But I think, you know, I think the what I really got from that experience was that my father was a man who was utterly unshockable. There was nothing that any human being had ever done to another human being that surprised him or shocked him in a moral sense, because everything he had already seen and dealt with and treated psychiatrically. And I think that's what I took from my childhood that I then found spilling into my fiction the minute I started writing, really. It was that lovely unshockability, which was allied to a sort of a compassion, a real compassion. He saw these men who the popular press would think of as monsters, would call monsters, but for him they were suffering human beings who deserved the best care and attention that this mental hospital could give them.
And I think somewhere you said that that writing for you is a bit like being a psychiatrist, but perhaps without the effects that you're curing people.
Well, I find that idea sort of inescapable.
Yes.
You know, in as much as the novelist is exploring human nature, is trying to create characters and then probe them in order to discover what motivates their behaviour, usually behaviour that is often inappropriate or violent or self-destructive in some way. And as we do that, as we work out our characters' stories, I think we are doing what psychiatrists do, although, as you say, psychiatrists do to try and help people, you know, get along with their and solve their problems, whereas we do it just to entertain each other.
And examine each other.
That too.
Yes. And what do you feel about the use of the word Gothic and your categorization as a Gothic writer?
Well, I suppose, you know, it's sort of irresistible, I suppose, because it's sort of in thematic terms. I have to say I'm very interested in decay in all forms. I'm interested in transgression. I'm interested in the sort of things that my father was interested in, the limits to which human beings will go as a result of bad circumstances and bad decisions and bad luck. And that does tend to propel you into the realm of the Gothic, although I try to avoid thunderstorms and houses with towers as much as possible, but I kind of didn't manage it in this terribly well.
No, and I wanted to ask you, in fact, what was your starting point for this novel? Was it Constance? Was it that the house on the Hudson, which is tiny bit Gothic.
It's a tiny bit Gothic.
We know the boathouse with the boats in it, the devastation, the bringing down of Penn Station. Where was your, or was it Iris, the sexy, louche, enchanting sister? Where did you start from?
You had it right with your first suggestion. It was the house. I'd seen this house. It's in the Hudson Valley. It's about 100 miles north of New York. It's called Wilderstein. And it is basically a rather modest Italianate American villa that in the late 1800s, as the family prospered, had all sorts of additions added to it, that including a tower, that was a cone, conical part, thing up top, and a veranda. And so it became romanticized or gothicized, which was the fashion, architectural fashion of that time. And so I saw that house and I thought, well, first of all, I'd like to tell a story about the people who live in that house. And then I thought, if I did, I would get to drive up and down the Hudson River for weeks, months, years on end, researching. And so it turned out more years than I anticipated. But I still got to go up and down the Hudson River a lot. And then it didn't take me long to realize that this house stands on a bluff high above the Hudson, and down just beside the river there's a railway line, and then of course the Hudson itself. And I thought, now if you've got a railway line, you've got a river, well, you can drown somebody in the river, and you can throw people in front of the trains. And in that sense, I suppose a sort of a Gothic impulse could be detected in the way I started to think about the story I was going to tell about that house.
At the time when Port Mungo was published, I think it was around then, you were interviewed, and you've lived now in America for what, over 30 years, something like that?
Yes.
You said, or you were quoted as saying, that one of the things about living in America is that you look forwards and you don't look back and you don't dwell on the past. And perhaps at that moment with that book, there was this step forwards, which I'm quite interested in, interested in trying to work out what that was. But it seems to me that with Constance, you are much more following the reflection on the past and what the past does to you. So do you think that at that time in America, you felt that things were going to be different? What was that part?
I've always found it difficult not to deal with the past. I think there's only one novel I've managed to just sort of go in a straight chronological line, which was Asylum. But it seems to me that inevitably to understand a person is to it requires knowledge of their past. And this may be another instance in which psychiatry and writing novels and what in common is that it is difficult to know a person without understanding the sorts of circumstances in which they grew up, what their family background was. And it's usually in the family background that you can come at the conflicts and traumas that have the most powerful effect on the development of people.
Mm. Didn't you work in a mental institution in Canada at some point?
When I left England when I was 21, my father, at 21 I was very, very aimless and sort of hopeless young man, and my father said, I can get you a job in a mental hospital in Northern Ontario. Would you like that? This was in his gift because he knew medical superintendents all over the world. So he was, I think, just calling in a favour here. He said, can you look after this boy who doesn't know where he's going or what he's up to? So I said yes, and so I then spent the next couple of years in a fascinating mental hospital in Northern Ontario.
And what were you doing there?
Well, I was a social work assistant and then a research assistant. So I had a degree in English, so I was not much use to them, other than being on the ward and helping out the patients with whatever needed, writing letters to their lawyers or playing chess or whatever seemed to be useful. And then I started working for a psychologist who was doing a serious experiment on inhibition and working with highly violent patients. And that was fascinating work and propelled me towards psychology, but I never got there. Mm. Got sidetracked into writing and never went back.
And how did that happen?
I went to graduate school and found that while I enjoyed the writing that was demanded of me, called the academic aspect of writing seemed to involve that you couldn't write a single sentence without then finding authorities to which you would then footnote. And so any sense of being able to write in a flowing manner, to just allow your thoughts, your imagination to express itself, was clearly not what academic writing is all about. So the appetite for writing having been aroused, I then said, well, that I will not do. I'm now going out on my own, hung up my shingle, and said, right, from now on it's fiction or nothing.
Very rash.
Very rash. But I had no debts, and I was unmarried, so there was not a lot to lose apart from time.
Yes. And living in America, coming from Britain and living in America, how does that work for you and your writing?
I think it worked very well in the first years in New York, when I wrote stories and novels about England, set in England, but not an England that I knew at first hand. It was an England that was composed of memories from my childhood, from movies, from novels. So I was able to invent an England and then happily write stories set in that England without ever having to sort of match it up to the reality. So I got a sort of certain freedom from being far away from the place it is and being not accountable to the world immediately around me. And that lasted for quite some years. And then I thought I must actually give an account of New York. I've lived here for 15, 20 years. It's time I took stock of my surroundings and gave life to the city that I've made my home in.
And that, I suppose, was trauma was the first completely New York.
There were no Europeans in trauma at all.
Yes. And that you wrote after... what was supposed to be the non-fiction book.
Yes.
So do you think that there was a connection that stepping into Manhattan to do the Writer in the City book?
Well, it actually happened two books earlier in the historical novel,
yes.
Martha Peake.
Yes.
Which I wrote because I wanted to explore the American Revolution in the light of that war as the struggle between the colonists and the empire, in the belief that I would then understand something about America, which had eluded me thus far. And in a sense, it did give me an idea of what America was all about, at least in its in the years when the Republic was founded. And it was also fun to sort of throw those bits of my life, the England and American aspects of my life, and sort of throw them into a historical context and make them clash, put them in opposition to one another.
And your historical, obviously it's very near history, setting of Constance, why did you choose that moment?
I didn't choose it, but as when I started writing, I thought when I sort of had a feeling it was maybe the 50s, maybe the 60s, and I think I just was...
It started a little earlier, didn't it? And it shifted.
It shifted, it did. It was in part because I wanted Constance to be not yet a liberated woman, so to see her struggling against a husband who assumed that this rather condescending, paternalistic attitude towards her, which would have been quite standard in those days. I then discovered that in 1963 they started to tear down the old Penn Station, which was a magnificent railway station, like a great cathedral. I realised that if my people were up the Hudson and in Manhattan, they would have to pass through Penn Station whenever they shifted between the family home and their new lives, the two sisters. And I discovered that Penn State, as it was being demolished, it was still in use, so that passengers were sitting there amongst cranes and jackhammers and men in hard hats and great tarpaulins as the thing was pulled down around them. And nobody protested. It was an act of huge vandalism. And New Yorkers at that time were apathetic to their own architecture. And so I was able to have the sisters and the father move in and out of this this ruin in the making. And that I thought was, I could make something of that. But at the same time, I wanted to suggest that Constance is sort of the last unliberated woman, and that in five years' time, that story wouldn't be possible. Mm. No woman would stand up for what Sydney and her father had sort of imposing on her.
Would anyone like to ask any questions?
I'd like to know about your mother.
Oh, would you?
Good question.
She was a lovely woman, and she was from County Mayo, and she had great charm. She was a lovely singer. She loved literature, and it was only when I married my wife Mariah, who is that I realised that she was actually the power in my home. I had this dynamic father who ran an institution and charged about the place and lost his temper and was fierce and clever and altogether a dominant figure in the home. But it took Mariah to point out to me that actually my quiet, laughing mother kind of ran things. And so she was a woman of I suppose, a sort of a subtle strength. As well as having this sort of this lovely lightness of spirit, what else can I tell you, Jemima?
Just how she dealt with seeing her children around these types of people.
I think she was probably 27 or 28 when we went there. And she enjoyed herself immensely. It was very social.
Was she the inspiration then for Asylum?
I can't say that because, she wasn't at all like Stella. Stella, of course, has a torrid affair with one of the patients, runs away and drowns her child. I can't say that my mother was capable of any of those things. But there was a lot of parties, I remember, growing up. It was pointed out to my father at one point that all of the consultant psychiatrists that he'd hired to work in Bournemouth happened to be Irish, and ought he not to be hiring English psychiatrists, maybe? The story is that it hadn't occurred to him that he was hiring Irish psychiatrists, but it did make for a tremendous social life. My mother enjoyed that, and she was also very warm. She enjoyed the company of the patients who worked on the estate, and so she fitted in very well. She wasn't in the least bit
She accepted my father's work as being what he defined it as, which was medical work. He was a doctor. This was his hospital. Its inmates were his patients, and he and his colleagues were treating them. And so we always understood Broadmoor through this sort of this medical model, my mother no less than any of the rest of us. And so we were basically a hospital family.
Claire. Just
I don't think I've read Jung for many, many years. I dip into Freud quite often and find him very suggestive. But I don't think as novelists we take anything as sort of theoretically true. You know, truth is a very shifty, difficult sort of concept. But he's very suggestive. And I've used Freudian ideas often, but sort of buried them within the characters and the story. And I think that I was reading a biography of Harold Pinter recently, and Michael Billington's biography, and Billington described Pinter's process as that he would go into some sort of a trance state lasting several weeks, in which he'd settle in and he'd write, and he wouldn't think about what he was writing, but he would be within the power of whatever idea was driving. And then when he was finished, it was as though the door to his unconscious that had been opened would snap shut, and the work would not be accessible to him in that way again. And I think there's something about, you know, all writers have something of that you go into this state, this zone when you write, and you take what you get on the page, and then you shape it afterwards. You edit it, you rewrite it, you see where it's taking you, what is interesting, what is coming off well, and it often is not what you thought you were going to write. So you abandon the plan that you had made about where your story was going to go. And then you do the same thing the next day, usually, for me, sort of early in the morning. And you just keep doing it, and what you produce is often very surprising, and often very disappointing, and much of it gets thrown away. But eventually, through this process of just sort of, you know, sinking these probes into your unconscious mind, you start to get images and ideas, and then it's your task to make into some sort of coherent narrative.
So the answer is yes.
Oh. What, regarding Freud?
Yeah, regarding Jung.
Oh, Jung, is that right? Oh.
Well, aren't you describing a kind of collective unconsciousness
in a way? I feel that it's my individual unconscious that I'm getting at. I don't know that these are sort of universal symbols that come up. They feel a bit too weird to me as a general rule to be universal.
I remember being very intrigued by the unreliable narrator in Portmongo, and I wonder if your contact at an early age with patients who were unreliable and perhaps deluded made you more interested in characters who weren't conventionally likeable and who were just, you know, in denial in some ways about aspects of their personality, and whether you would find it boring to write about characters who were very sort of normal and well balanced. I mean, I certainly would be more bored to read about characters who were well balanced.
I'm not sure I believe in normal, well balanced people.
But are all, I mean, all your narrative, the unreliable narrator, is sort of very important.
I think
everyone is.
I think everybody is an unreliable narrator. I do believe that, that each one of us who gives an account of our experiences cannot possibly hope to present an objective, what would be an objective account of one's experience. It's sort of, you know, it defies definition somehow. I chanced upon the unreliable narrator quite early on, writing a story in the first person, and then it began to dawn on me that every time you begin a story with the word I, you're about to tell lies, more or less. And even when you tell somebody, you know, when you sit in a pub with somebody and tell them about what happened yesterday, what happened when I was a child, and so forth, you're probably, without intending to, telling lies. It's impossible for us to do otherwise, I think.
Truth is always subjective, isn't
it? It very, indeed. It's entirely subjective.
Patrick, I've heard you read twice now, and it occurs to me when I heard you read tonight just how much more intimate you are with Constance than Sydney is. And he has to live with her. So I wonder, she's such a, you know, rich, complicated, aggravating, just sexy and incredible character that sometimes, like, I thought reading it, I couldn't stand to be in the room with her another minute. And then she would be just fabulous with Howard, the stepson. Uh-huh. So I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about what you decided to arm Sydney with in order to be with her.
Oh, very good question, Elizabeth. What Sydney? I had a picture of Sydney as not as terrible a man as many people think him. I think he's, and there's a certain point early where he says, you know, I'm with Goethe on disturbed marriages. I think, you know, stoic nobility of spirit is the thing. You don't let go. So there's a way in which Sydney has had two failed marriages, and he's determined not to do it again, and has decided that marriage is in fact a sort of a moral project. And so no matter how badly Constance behaves, or how difficult she is, how inaccessible and mysterious to him she is, he has made a decision, and it's a moral decision, and so he's not going to let go in a hurry, because, in part, because he doesn't want to be, you know, have lost a third marriage, but also because he thinks it would be morally wrong to just give up because the going got rough. So I think this is in Sydney's favour, that he does love Constance in his way. He certainly desires her. But he has a moral determination to not let the marriage fail. He almost lets go of it in the last... Well, I won't talk about the last pages. Does that do it?
Patrick, what are we to take from this novel of your touching on nature and the sublime and sort of faint reference to Caspar David Friedrich, I took it to be, and you mentioned early on, or the writer mentions, that Constance is so very keen on nature, and I found that incredibly mysterious the more I've thought about it, and I wonder if it, I mean, your definition of the sublime is quite intriguing. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, Sydney has rather a good idea. Sydney, of course, is a professor of romantic poetry, so the sublime and nature would be very central to his thinking. Do you know, I don't know that I thought terribly deeply about that. I was, I suppose I responded to the natural beauty and the sublimity of the Hudson Valley, and wanted to describe that simply because it was there and it deserved being described, I thought.
It's very beautiful as well.
Thank you. And I suppose when I thought about the relationships, the marriage, the individuals in the story, I connected them more with the collapse of Penn Station, with
the ruin that is going forward. And so I could maybe suggest that the sort of the ruin of Penn Station and the river, the mountains, the beauty of the Hudson Valley could be seen as in some sort of opposition, some two different terms of a romantic argument. But I haven't really thought about that too much. I just like the notion of doing natural beauty.
With the speed of information nowadays and also the kind of dilution of any sense of taboo with mental illness, the stories that you write, do you think they're kind of naturally consigned to the 19th and 20th century? And moving forward, can you see yourself kind of writing in the digital age?
That's a very good question, and I've wrestled with that myself and thought, should I be writing about the year 2013 rather than the year 1963? Ought I to be doing that? And sometimes I guess I ought to, and then when I start writing, I sort of tend to want to just sort of push it all back a bit, where I have some detachment and distance and don't have to deal with digital information and the way that people now do communicate, and the technology that enables people to communicate so differently than they did, even a decade ago. Oddly enough, being in London for the last 2 weeks has made me want to write a novel set in London in 2013. I don't quite know why. I think it may be something to do with faces, which I've seen very different from American faces. And arouse a response in me that's much more vivid. I think I know these faces. I know what's behind these faces. I did grow up here, even though just been all. And I don't know Americans. You can never know the country into which you immigrate, because they're always somehow mysterious to you. You didn't grow up there, and so it occurs to me that I could do. Do the present, but not in America. America's much too complicated. But I think England, with that extra bit of privileged knowledge that I have of England, having grown up here, that I might be able to do that. So that is just off the top of my head. I think it's a good question.
I think that's a wonderful case to end, which is facing into the future.
Yeah.
Maybe the future in England. In 2013, whenever it happens. And thank you so much, Patrick. It was wonderful to hear you read and talk about all your work, and especially about Constance. Thank you.